Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. John, as you know, we've tried to take a different tack in this pandemic to get away from the hype and get to the real-world solutions. We've hit the ball out of the park with our next guest, without question, our interview of the day for those of you coast-to-coast and indeed worldwide, scared stiff about the kids and education. Abigail Wozniak has an extraordinary CV out of Chicago and Harvard, her tour of duty in Notre Dame, and here she is now at Minneapolis. What you need to know is Minneapolis owns the high ground on children education in America. Professor, wonderful to have you with us. You have written on the inequalities of this virus. We are living it now in July, August, and into September with public school kids crushed by budgets, fiscal, the rest, and fancy private school kids actually maybe will be able to go back to school. That's just one inequality that we have. How do we solve this?
Right. So I think that one of the things that we really want to highlight coming out of the latest research is something that I think is going to help us think about the trade-offs of some of the policies governors are considering reimposing. And of course, any progress that we make in containing the virus is going to have serious ramifications for our children. What we want to highlight is the fact that after a few months and weeks with this virus, we've been able to understand what's happening to labor markets in places where different policies have been adopted. And a really striking finding coming out of many pieces of research, I've seen this repeatedly in very timely research seminars this early summer, is that states that have had strict and early lockdowns are seeing labor market changes that are really just as significant as states that did not lock down. So what that's telling us is that the economic impacts of the virus are happening regardless of the specific lockdown measures states put in place.
What we've witnessed here, and John Farrow, as the foreigner from England, has really noticed this, it's without question the gains of the stimulus has gone to Wall Street. We saw this with Morgan Stanley's earnings and, you know, the rest of them, Goldman Sachs and all. What is the policy's prescription you would advocate so that we get a bit of equality across society right now in the crisis?
Yeah, so I think with this new information that we have that the virus contraction is hitting all states regardless of their shutdown practices, we really see that it's imperative that support continue for workers and small and medium-sized businesses. And I think some of the evidence that we're seeing on consumer finances, so from researchers who have access to, for example, bank account and credit card spending data, even for very low income households, we can sometimes see them in such data. It really does look like some of these fiscal policies have definitely made it to those households. Now, that doesn't mean that that's erased the financial hardship of the pandemic. For many households, they're treading water. For many households, they're still facing significant financial uncertainty. We see that in the data that I study that looks at food insecurity and inability to make mortgage payments on time. But we definitely, it would be an overstatement to say that those stimulus and extended benefits packages that were in place under the CARES Act, it would be an overstatement to say that they haven't made it to Main Street or to many American households. What we need is to have those policies likely continue because we are right back where we started. In fact, we're even worse off right now in terms of the virus. And so engaging in a second round of such packages, I think, could help prevent an economic disaster that will follow as the virus continues to spread in the next couple of weeks.
Abigail, what you're saying is so, so powerful. Let me repeat it. There is no connection between labor markets and virus protection policy. What does that mean for reopening? There are some people that think we could see some divergence across states, say New York, across some of the states across the Sun Belt, for instance. Are you saying that we won't see that divergence?
We will not see nearly as much divergence as I think people expect. I think people have come to view containment policy as a trade-off, where if we engage in containment policy, we are going to lose out economically. And they're seeing them as kind of a one-to-one trade-off. And what we've come to learn is that this is much more of an investment. If you invest in containment policy now, it pays benefits in that your economy can open sooner and faster. And the reason we're not seeing as much of a connection, that one-to-one trade-off, is that people are making behavior changes on their own. That's a first reason. And so folks are just not going to go out and they're not going to spend at the same levels if they feel insecure about their family's safety and their own health. The other reason we're not seeing that divergence that we might expect is that state economies are connected to one another. So if one of them is very slowed down, it's going to affect other state economies throughout the U.S. So what we're seeing is that the labor market is not the same as the virus market.
Abigail, this is such an important point. And you say shutdown orders work. They work not only to control the virus, but for the economy. That said, if there is not some sort of lockdown, if there isn't a stricter enforcement of some of these policies to constrain the virus, is any extra stimulus throwing money, good money after bad, this idea that the bridge to the other side is becoming a bridge to nowhere?
So I share some of those concerns. I see concerns that folks have about these packages. What we also see in the data is that significant numbers of folks are very concerned about their ability to continue to stay in their housing. We know that housing disruption is significant for families that experience it, and it would be significant for our cities and communities. I think, in my view, preventing large-scale housing displacement when the next round of mortgage payments and rent payments come due is really critical. So some of this policy, I definitely agree, it's a challenge to think of exactly the right level, but we need to prevent that next wave of collapse.
Professor, one final question, unfair, but it is the heritage of the Minneapolis Fed folks. They own pre-school education, nursery school education, and all the benefits of that. Abigail Wozniak, really simply, does distance learning work for kids? I haven't observed it. Tell me it works, please.
I'm sad to say that it does not work well, particularly for disadvantaged students. Really striking data from Brown University, looking at, they actually had a study in progress, is my understanding, when the pandemic hit, tracking students' performance using one of these online math modules that I think a lot of us have probably encountered now, even though we didn't go to school with them when we were growing up. They kind of were collecting this data in the background. Pandemic hit, you can see how much learning loss has happened for students.
Yep.
Overall, across the board, but most significantly for students from lower income households. So it's certainly helpful to have in place, but it's not a good substitute. It's not making up the ground. And I think we need to think really seriously about how we're gonna put that back. These are, again, investments that we've foregone in the last couple of months. How are we gonna make this up to our children in the coming months and years when the pandemic has passed?
Abigail, a conversation we need to continue. A really powerful conversation as well. Abigail Wozniak there of the Minneapolis Fed.
What we're going to do is get right to it right now with a brief to get you ready for the weekend and, frankly, to stagger to Q3. We can do that with Brian Levitt, who really filters in all sorts of thinking as global market strategist for the large platform of Invesco. Brian, an open question to begin. What are you writing on into the end of July?
Well, I think the biggest question that I keep being asked is about the shape of the recovery. And I think that, you know, there's so much concern about whether it's V-shaped, whether it's W-shaped, and whether it's U-shaped. And, you know, the reality is I think it's going to be a prolonged, protracted recovery, intermittent with fits and starts. But if you go back and you look historically at different recoveries, I mean, you can look at the one from the early 2000s, more V-shaped, early 1980s, more W-shaped, 2008-2009, more U-shaped. The reality is markets actually did quite well, actually did best in that U-shape. So, you know, I'm I'm expecting some volatility in the near term, fits and starts, yeah. concerns about reopening, but a protracted U-shaped recovery can actually right. be just fine for the equity market.
John, it's hard to believe I made a mistake in the data check that I did up top. I really need to point out, John, that futures with a churning here that we've seen has brought a VIX down to 27.08. That's not normal. That's a real change, John.
Volatility, though, Tom, has remained elevated through all of this and hasn't corrected lower in a material way for quite a while. And Brian's point is basically that an anemic recovery could be sufficient for an economic recovery to be shallow. It does not mean that this market can't rebound quickly. Brian, is that the point you're trying to make here?
Yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make. I mean, we learned that coming out of the financial crisis. Investors largely bemoaned the weak recovery for a number of years, waiting for things to start to look good, waiting for jobless claims to get back to average, all these different things. By the time all of that happened, the markets had already staged a pretty sizable advance. So, yeah. I think it's, obviously we're all monitoring mobility. We're all monitoring reopening. I think if those things turn, you will have volatility in markets. We should expect uncertainty to lead to volatility. My point is, if you're a longer term investor, focus more on whether things are getting better or worse rather than whether they're good or bad. Even if they're getting better modestly, slowly, markets should do well. And remember, it's going to be a very long time until we get back to full employment, a very long time until there's some pickup in inflation expectations, which means policy is likely to be accommodative well into the future.
Well, Brian, let's take a 5-year time horizon, shall we? We have had people lining up to get overweight Europe versus the United States. Is that the right idea?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about the non-U.S. markets is it looks like we may be, for the first time in a while, in an environment where the dollar is stable or dare we even say weaker. The aftermath of the financial crisis was strong dollar. The U.S. emerged from it in a better position, and it looked as if the Federal Reserve did ultimately raise rates before the rest of the world did. Now you're in an environment where the U.S. is struggling to come out of it. The dollar is under some pressure as policy becomes very accommodative, and that's likely to persist. So what that enables you to do as a U.S.-denominated investor, as a U.S.-domiciled investor, is to start to look to other parts of the world where valuations are more attractive. I would say, though, within all of that, when you're looking international, I would still favor the more growthier parts of the market rather than looking for, the more economically sensitive parts of the market that'll require a pretty significant acceleration in economic activity in Europe. I would instead say who are the growers, who are the companies that are on the cutting edge of structural changes in society. Those are the types of names I'd be allocating to outside of the United States.
Brian, this is such an important point, this idea of going to Europe over the U.S., and that's currently been what a lot of investors have been saying, which is why the euro is the strongest versus the dollar since early March. And yet we have this meeting heading into tomorrow in Brussels that looks somewhat tenuous in terms of them actually getting a deal done. What is the downside risk, not only to the euro, but just the entire European risk market, should they fail to come to some sort of accord?
Yeah, it's a great point. And, in any nascent recovery, if you don't get the policy mix right, then, that nascent recovery is not going to persist for too long. So much like in the United States, how we have to get the policy mix right, not only monetary, fiscal and reopening, the same can be said for Europe. And, perhaps a silver lining in all of this, if we can even find silver lining, is that this may lead us to more Europe rather than less. And that's what we've all largely been clamoring for some time, the Hamiltonian moment, the United States of Europe, the joint borrowing, the closer fiscal union. That could be a silver lining in this. To your point, if Europe doesn't get the policy mix right, then, it's likely that we'll see a number of years that looked like, unfortunately, what we saw in the aftermath of 08. We're hopeful and we'll be watching closely.
The unicorns, the rainbows, the lollipops, we all want it to happen, Brian. I'm conditioned by the last 10 years to be skeptical about it. Why is it going to change? I've been so disappointed by policymakers in Europe. And I want to reemphasize something I said a little bit earlier. This is not a political point. It's not about political bias. This is a point about politics. The politicians on the continent, regardless of whether they are on the left or the right, Brian, they have disappointed again and again in Europe. We've seen it on the far left in Europe, seen it on the far right in Europe. Disappointment after disappointment. When does it change?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen disappointment. I mean, obviously less so from the European Central Bank, but more so from the elected officials. And, you know, perhaps, Jonathan, desperate times call for desperate measures. We will find out. You know, let's wait and see what the days bring us. But I believe that, you know, what we've seen is incremental steps. It's been a very gradual move towards, you know, more Europe rather than less. I think, you know, if we go back to 2011, 2012, during the European debt crisis, concerns that, you know, the union was breaking up, concerns that they're going to move away from the common currency. And yet here we are. And so we do things incrementally around the world politically. And let's hope that directionally those incremental steps continue to be favorable. And again, my point is maybe this becomes something of a silver lining out of all of this.
Hopefully. Brian, great to catch up with you, sir. My best to the team over at Invesco. Brian Levitt there of Invesco.
We never agree. Lisa agrees with me maybe once every 3 weeks. Pharaoh and I haven't agreed since Christmas. We all agreed we've got to talk to Wolfgang Munchau of Euro Intelligence with not only his expertise on Europe and what it means for our political economics, but just as importantly, Wolfgang Munchau's definitive knowledge of Germany.
John? It was Christmas 2015, just to clarify, Tom.
Thank you. Thank
goes
you.
Back a lot further yeah. than some people believe. And there was a lot of drink involved too. Wolfgang Munchau joins us now. He, of course, is from Euro Intelligence, the director there. Wolfgang, fantastic to catch up with you, sir. There has been a shift in Europe, Wolfgang. Talk to us about Chancellor Merkel's shift in the last 10 years, the difference in this crisis compared to the previous crisis, and what's driving it?
The difference is that in the previous crisis, she refused point blank to even discuss the possibility of joint borrowing and a joint fiscal effort. That was the case in 2012. And that is the decision that then prompted Mario Draghi to act in as forcefully the way he did. And this was at the time Germany was not prepared for that discussion. Her party was not prepared. Her country was not prepared for that discussion. And also in Germany, the Germans had framed the euro crisis as pretty much a fiscal crisis, a crisis of irresponsibility. I disagreed with that framing, but it was very much the way it was talked about in Germany. The Greeks, the Italians, everyone were living beyond their means. And in that situation, it was impossible to act jointly. What is different now were the television pictures coming from Bergamo during the coronavirus crisis. The Germans felt really sorry for Italians, and there was a great groundswell of sympathy for what happened and for the need to show solidarity. So Merkel sensed that shift in public mood quickly and decided that this is a good moment for a joint effort. Now, one has to be very clear, this is not Germany shifting on euro bonds and fiscal federalism or any of these things. This is a one-off. Merkel wanted a big one-off gesture, which is why she and Emmanuel Macron, President of France, agreed this 500 billion proposal of a one-time fiscal stimulus to be stretched over a number of years. And this is what they're discussing in Brussels today.
There is a belief, Wolfgang, though, that this sets a precedent, that this becomes a mechanism to do the same thing over and over again. Are you saying that won't be the case?
Absolutely, that won't be the case. The whole legal basis for this thing is that it is a one-off. One of the big misunderstandings of in the debate is that people regard this as the beginning of a wider process. It may do that. That may well, but that it would have yet to happen. Legally, this is a one-off. They can't do this again. So what will need to happen for this to become the first step in a multi-stage process would be for the member states of the EU to change their treaties, to say the Eurobond is now part of what we are doing, the joint fiscal action is part of what we're doing, and I see absolutely zero chance of that happening. The Dutch will certainly not agree to that, and I'm not even sure that the Germans, even Merkel at this stage, would not agree to that. What happens now in Brussels is a one-off, and this should be seen as a one-off. And it would be very, I think, reckless to think that this is sort of the beginning of the end of the Eurozone, you know, the Eurozone crisis, that we have kind of nailed it. we haven't nailed it.
Wolfgang Mancha, I want you to talk about the generational shift in the leadership that we will see this weekend. We remember the old horses of this development, Robert Schuman and the others who came out of World War II under exceptionally difficult circumstances and made this European Union. Is it a generational shift this weekend in Brussels?
I think it is a generational shift. This may well be one of Angela Merkel's last big appearances in Europe, and her term is still, she still has another year to go. But the new generation, the new senior guy in the room, that's clearly Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. There are the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz. There is a generation of younger prime ministers who, who are, as you mentioned, Schuman. And, this generation is very different. This generation was marked by the Second World War. They had in common a desire to build Europe. This generation was born into this Europe, and their desire is to carve out the most for their own countries. It's a very different mindset that has governed the Council. And the Council is an incredible deal-making machine.
Yeah.
They usually come together, but they're not, the spirit of the 1950s is clearly not there.
Real quick here, Wolfgang, I'm wondering, Mark Rutte has really come out as the leader of the Frugal Four. Does he have a point with his arguments against the scope of the 750 billion euro plan?
I think he has a number of good arguments and lots of bad arguments. The good argument is that it is absolutely wrong to pre-assign country allocations. So basically say Italy needs to get 80, Spain needs to get 80. And what happened, the Commission, gave that list of the countries on what countries get, and then they retrofitted the various criteria so that this was the outcome. And Rutte said this is a ridiculous way of proceeding. This is a backward look. You use backward-looking indicators. You basically, if you want to look at the effect of the crisis, we don't know the effect of the crisis, so you have to take current data. And current data may suggest that Belgium should get a bigger share because Belgium is actually suffering from the crisis quite as bad as some of the other countries are. So that's a good point, and one that I happen to agree with. What I don't agree with, of course, is this sort of general rejection of any kind of European solidarity, that everything has to be a loan, which is this position that countries need to reform as a quid pro quo to get the money. Now, I think they should reform. To link this to the money, I think, is a mistake. So there are lots of unreasonable aspects of it. But, the way the package is designed, it has made it open to valid criticism. The package is trying to do too much with too little money. It's trying to be a fiscal transfer. It's trying to be an investment program. And it's kind of trying to solve Italy's solvency issues all with one package, and it will not achieve that. This is just 500 billion or 750 billion, however it may be, however much it may be. You're not going to solve all of that with that one package.
Wolfgang, always appreciate your time. Stay close. We've got to get you back soon to follow up on this. Going into the weekend, Wolfgang Mancha there of Euro Intelligence.
Michael Mayo is with Wells Fargo. He's been doing this more than a long time and has always done it with a certain vigor, which upsets the executives and is required reading for everyone on the street. Mike Mayo, great to get an update from you. Let me go to the money question. They're lining up the accountant ducks of losses that will be taken down the road. Do you know what those losses will be taken down the road, or do you, like everybody else, have to wait?
Well, these are some of the most uncertain times, Tom, that I've seen in my three decades of covering banks. But we do have the results in for the eight largest banks. And the conclusion is you've seen the twin peaks of pain. The provisions for future loan losses relative to the actual losses these past two quarters have been the highest in history. And the second bit of pain is that the decline in the net interest margin these two past quarters has been the biggest in history. So there's a double barrel shotgun, pointed at the banks in terms of credit losses and NIM compression, and that's huge pain. But let me point out, this is not 2008, it's 2020. Banks are now part of the solution, not part of the problem. The war chest for future losses, whatever they will be, is the highest in history at this stage of a recession in the past 50 years. The reserves for the largest banks equal half the level of the actual losses during the global financial crisis. Even with this huge buildup of provisions or reserves for future problems, banks still grew capital, still grew book value for the most part, and still for the most part cover their dividends sometimes by one, two, or three times. So, and banks are still open for business.
Yeah.
The growth in deposits at Bank America and JP Morgan, wow. I mean, over the past year, they grew equal to the fifth or sixth largest bank. So I give the banks for the second quarter earnings a B plus, but when it comes to the outlook, Tom, nobody knows. It's a very uncertain time, so you need to be ready for a variety of scenarios.
I love having you on, Mike, as always. Twin Peaks of Pain, you have a way with words. Pair the Twin Peaks of Pain with the record revenues, the record income from investment banking and trading volumes. How much does this bring up political risk for the banks at a pretty unseemly time, the idea of profiting at a time of such economic pain?
Well, look, banks are serving customers. And sometimes, like in March, banks were serving customers with record lending as revolvers were getting drawn down. In the second quarter, banks were serving customers by issuing debt to the capital markets, record debt issuance year to date. And it's natural that you have strong trading that follows that. So whether you serve clients with lending or if you serve them with capital markets, you're still serving clients. So I'd say that criticism is more of a 20th century criticism. In the 21st century, financial world, you're serving the customer if you're a large bank.
Looking forward, given the uncertainty, given the likely pain in the consumer that a lot of big bank executives are expecting, which financial firm is best positioned to increase profitability going forward based on these results?
Well, look, you have the Twin Peaks of Pain. The good news is that the reserves for those future losses, have been built more than ever before. These are sobering times. We expect loan losses to increase by about threefold over the next couple years. But the other part of the pain, the net interest margin, should hurt the more plain vanilla banks more than anyone else. So we're going with the largest banks, Citigroup, Bank America, and JP Morgan, because they are more diversified. They have more levers to pull. And digital banking is being dominated by the largest banks because they have better technology. You're seeing the market share there, and you're seeing an acceleration of their 5 or 10 year plans into the next year because customers have been forced out of the banks.
Mike Mayo, can you explain why Goldman Sachs wants to be a plain vanilla bank?
Of all the ironies, Goldman Sachs' strategy has become more bank-like. And then you see the second quarter results. They knocked the cover off the ball with fantastic underwriting, again, serving clients, trading. The traditional roots of Goldman Sachs really came out. So this quarter showed you that Goldman Sachs is still Goldman Sachs like they've been for over the past 100 years and not what they want to be in the future.
Michael Mayo, thank you so much. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. With Wells Fargo, as always, must read on the street. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.